Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning author and journalist Geraldine Brooks. Brooks grew up in the western suburbs of Sydney, Australia. She attended Bethlehem College, Ashfield, and the University of Sydney before winning a scholarship to Columbia University School of Journalism in New York. She worked for many years for the Wall Street Journal, covering crises in the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans. She is the author of many best-selling books, including People of the Book and March, for which she won the 2006 Pulitzer Prize. She is also author of the highly acclaimed memoir, Foreign Correspondence, and her most recent is the best-selling Caleb's Crossing, a work of historical fiction about Martha's Vineyard in the 1600s, when the first Native American attended Harvard University. I'm talking to Geraldine Brooks by phone from her home on Martha's Vineyard. Geraldine Brooks, thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to be with you, Tish.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about your memoir, Foreign Correspondence. Caleb's Crossing takes place in Martha's Vineyard, which you first heard about as a teen in Sydney, Australia, when you had a pen pal whose family spent summers there. Tell us a little bit about that.
Not even a teen. I think I was about 11 years old, and Star Trek arrived on our TV screens, and I became a tragic Trekkie, and I particularly loved Mr. Spock, so I wrote away to join the Leonard Nimoy fan club, and in the fan club newsletter, when it finally wended its way to suburban Sydney, there were a list of kids looking for pen pals, so I wrote to a girl my own age, and an answer came back from postmark Menemsha, which was a place I'd never heard of. And so over the course of our long epistolatory relationship, I learned that this was a beautiful place that had wonderful sunsets and that it was on an island off the coast of Massachusetts. And I thought, that's cool. When I finally got a chance to come to the United States as a graduate student at the Columbia Journalism School, I mentioned that one of the places I wanted to see before I went back to Australia was this place, Menemsha, on Martha's Vineyard. And one of my classmates said, oh, I go there all the time. In fact, I'm going there on the Labor Day weekend. Why don't you come with me? And to cut a long story short, reader, I married him.
Yes, and you fell in love with Martha's Vineyard at the same time.
At the same time, yeah.
Now, let's talk about Caleb's Crossing. What was the first seed that made you want to pursue this story?
The bold fact of the date of the first Native American graduating from Harvard. And after we decided to move to Martha's Vineyard, I was immersing myself in the culture and the people of the place. It's a pretty fascinating year-round community, and one of the things that fascinated me the most was the fact of this enduring Wampanoag community that has never been displaced from their own land. And I wanted to learn more about the tribe, and so I had gathered some materials that they'd prepared. And one was a map showing sites of significance to the Wampanoag on the island. And on the map was a notation, birthplace of Caleb, first Native American graduate of Harvard. And my eye just wasn't prepared to read the actual date. I saw something 65, and I filled in the blank as 1965 because that fit with what I knew about the rise of Indian political activism and the rise of the civil rights movement. And I thought 1965 sounds about right for when that bastion of white male waspy super privilege might have actually opened its gates.
Mm.
And so what did I know? Then I actually blinked and realized that the date was 1665.
God, that's amazing.
I was stunned by that, and I wanted to know more. And I learned that Harvard had actually been founded. The founding documents state that the aim of the college is the education of the English and Indian youth of this country. So it was right there from the beginning. And Caleb from Martha's Vineyard was the first Native American to graduate.
God, I can imagine why that caught your imagination. Now, the thing is that it's called Caleb's Crossing, but it's really this fascinating story about a very intelligent young woman named Bethia Mayfield. Tell us how you weaved her into this story.
Well, you know, as I started to think about how did Caleb get to Harvard, that leads you immediately to the English settlers who were on the island. And I'd always wondered why the island was settled so early, the first English community set up here in 1641. And I'd always thought, why would you do that? You know, I mean, why would you put 7 miles of treacherous ocean currents between yourself and the only other people like you at such a precarious time? Because heaven knows it's inconvenient enough living here today.
Mm-hmm.
So that led me to an interesting answer, which is this group of people came to the island because on an island they would be outside of the purview of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, which had become quite doctrinaire and Taliban-esque in having, you know, absolutely excoriating any deviation from the faith as they saw it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the people who came to the island were perhaps a little more liberal-minded. At least they wanted the chance to make their own way and not be subject to torture and exile if there was some doctrinal dispute.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the context in which Caleb obviously had been identified and initially educated. And I was thinking, well, who can tell this story? And I thought about it, and I'm always waiting for a voice from the past to start speaking to me. And I get some of my best ideas walking in old cemeteries, and I looked at a gravestone one day, and the name Bathiah was on the gravestone, and I thought, that's who it is. It will be the daughter of the minister of the English colony who will tell this story.
God, she's a fascinating character. I heard in an interview that you said you were inspired by a young woman that you met in the Middle East who would go up on
the roof. I didn't actually meet this young woman, but I did hear about her. She was in Afghanistan when the Taliban had banned women from going to school. And her brother, of course, attended school, and he would go next door to the madrasa. And she would climb up onto the roof, and from up there she couldn't be seen, but she could overhear all the classes taking place in the courtyard. And she got herself actually more educated than her brother, so when he came home, she would do his homework for him. And I thought about that necessity, that hunger for learning, and that you'll pursue it no matter what risks are involved. And it seemed apt, because I'm very drawn to voices from the past that haven't been heard in their own time.
Mm-hmm.
People who didn't get a chance to leave an immense record of what they were thinking and feeling. And unfortunately, that was the case for women in colonial America. We don't have any journals by women from the colonial period before 1700.
Yeah, that's remarkable.
And no really good ones
Wow.
before 1750, which is a whole 100 years later than my story's taking place. So I was thinking about that, and I read about Puritan ideas of women's education. They thought women should learn to read because it was a good thing for a Puritan goodwife to be able to read her Bible.
Mm-hmm.
But not write. Writing was considered a man's business because, after all, you write to communicate with people outside your own family. And why would a woman have any need to do that?
Mm-hmm. Well, you said that you found a lot of information about women's lives who were pretty much invisible and silent through court records. Tell us
about
that. Yeah,
that is
a
great place
fascinating.
To hear women speaking in their own voice, because the testimony is often taken down verbatim. And a lot of women were being dragged into court and being accused of being a scold, which was the crime of having been overheard criticizing a man in public.
Oh, God.
And it's a good thing that one's not still on the books. I spend a lot of time in court. More seriously, you know, there were charges of witchcraft and so forth. And they were pretty careful about taking down the questions and the answers. And you really can get a sense of women and women's outrage at these charges against them.
Mm-hmm.
And the sense that they had of how unjustly they were being dealt with. And I found court documents extremely useful in other novels, too. My first novel is set in the 1660s in a town in rural England. And, of course, there also the same kinds of attitudes to women prevailed, and there also many women didn't have a chance to become literate, so you have to find them
mm-hmm.
in unusual places, like in court.
Mm-hmm. I thought that was a very fascinating angle. I had never heard that. Now, you do extensive research for all of your books, so why do you not write nonfiction?
I'm really interested in following the historical record as far as it leads, but if there's too much information, then there's no room for imagination to work. So I'm looking for the stories where we can know some interesting things, but then right at a crucial point, the historical record falls silent. And the only way to engage with that history is through some kind of active, well-informed, empathetic imagination.
Mm-hmm.
So I like to follow the line of fact, and when it runs out, take the great leap off the precipice into imagining a version of how it possibly might have been.
Mm-hmm. Now, Caleb, of course, is a Native American. Did you find out a lot about Native Americans and how unusual Caleb was? To tell us about that setting.
He wasn't as unusual as I would have expected, because there was a tremendous push at this period to basically proselytize the Indians, to Christianize them.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of pressure on the colonists here from their brethren in England, who couldn't understand why it was such a slow business bringing these, you know, as they thought, lost pagans to Christianity. And so the idea was hatched and paid for by English Puritans that there should be an outreach to educate young, promising Indian youth, and that they might then in their turn become ministers of the cloth, and it would be easier for them to bring their brethren to Christianity than it was turning out for the English ministers, who had great difficulties with the languages and with the cultural concepts. And I think that what they were missing was that there's an absolute chasm in how, in the Indian cosmology and the way they saw the world and the way they thought you lived a good life in the world. So that was the culture clash that was coming.
Mm-hmm.
But in the 1660s, it hadn't really become ugly. It was still a time when the history could have gone in a completely different direction.
Mm-hmm.
And it all comes apart in 1675 when the two peoples go to bitter war with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, the educational experiments with young Indian youth are over. But during the 1660s to the 1670s, there were a number of kids who were plucked out of their communities and sent away to preparatory schools. And I think around about a dozen of them made it to Harvard.
Wow.
But Caleb, obviously, and his friend and fellow vineyard Wampanoag Joel Iakins were remarkable scholars by every account. And they really excelled in the intellectual world, more than held their own with the sons of the Puritan elite.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Geraldine Brooks. We're talking about her book, Caleb's Crossing. Now, did writing Caleb's Crossing and doing all this research about your beautiful home of Martha's Vineyard change your impression of the place at all?
It just deepened my affection for this place, I think. I did learn a great deal more about the rich Wampanoag culture and history and ongoing contributions to the environment here, and, you know, it did bring me closer to the tribe, which was great, and it was a fantastic thing to be writing a book about the place where you live. And lucky for us, even though the island is changed in an ecological sense, because 100 or 200 years ago, it would have been much more clear-felled for pasture. It was a big sheep-producing place for a number of years. And those woods have grown back. They're not virgin woods anymore. But still, there are places on the island where you can climb up to a high point and you can look from one shore to another and not see anything of the hand of man at all. And so that was fantastic, because I could squint a little bit and imagine how Caleb and Bathiah had seen the place and what they had experienced as they walked the woods and hunted and gathered and survived in the different harsh and mellow seasons of the year here.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel as you're walking around Martha's Vineyard that you can feel the ghosts of some of the characters you've created?
Yes, I'm very susceptible to this.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine.
And you do. I mean, I still very much do hear their voices, as I imagine they might have expressed themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it comes across certainly in the book. Now, many of your characters are dealing with these huge, often really terrible, catastrophic events. Do you think your experience as a journalist has helped you explore some of these issues in a more realistic way?
I absolutely do. I draw on experiences I had covering conflicts over a solid decade when I was a news correspondent in the Middle East and in Africa and the Balkans, and there were some really, really terrible catastrophes that I witnessed and witnessed how human beings dealt with a complete, you know, turnover in their circumstances, you know, and how some people are drawn to become stronger and better in a time of crisis, and others just become despicably cruel or unable to function. And so I'm able to draw on all that when I create characters living through terrible crises in the past.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, America is obviously your adopted country. Did some of the research that you did about our often less than noble past change your feelings at all about the U.S.?
I was pretty well informed on that front.
Mm-hmm.
My father was an American
mm-hmm.
who left the United States behind and settled in Australia and really had no wish whatsoever to return. He was quite alienated, I think, from some of the aspects of what he considered, you know, the cruelties of the culture. So it wasn't out of a void learning these things. Also, my husband, Tony Horwitz, is quite a historian himself, so it's pretty much the water we swim in our family. He's just completed a book called Midnight Rising about John Brown and the history of the abolitionist movement, and before that, the Civil War. So I know that there's plenty of dark past, but then there's plenty of dark past to go around in every country, too.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. You know what I wanted to ask you, too? Do you know any Native Americans in Martha's Vineyard, and have you talked to some contemporary families and discussed
many,
the book?
Oh, many, many, many. And it was essential to do so because the Wampanoag here, despite a century or more of terrible pressure to become deracinated and to lose their culture, never did so. And so they're very, very in touch with their history and their culture, and they've kept it alive, and they've revived many of the wonderful old life ways and dances and songs and traditions as the culture has become more open to that
mm-hmm.
in the last century. So that was a fantastic resource that I was able to draw on. And also I came to know, perhaps, you know, Caleb's descendant in a way is a young woman called Tiffany Smalley, who graduated from Harvard this year. And she was the first Island Wampanoag to graduate from the college since Caleb, and even though a number of others have gone to the graduate schools there. So that was quite a marvelous thing to have the coincidence of her graduation just around the same time as this book was published.
Wow, that's amazing.
And she's really a remarkable young leader. Mm-hmm. She's working in Washington now on Native American affairs, so I think we'll hear more from her.
Mm-hmm. Have you, as you've gone around the country on tour with this book, have you met up with other Native Americans in other parts of the country?
Yeah, I have, particularly when I was in New Mexico. And that was fantastic. And in some of the Native American schools out west, the book is being adopted and discussed in class. And, you know, it's not without issues. There are a lot of issues about who has the right to tell this story.
I would assume.
And not all Native Americans think that fictionalizing history and writing about somebody who really lived and about whom we actually know depressingly little detail.
Mm-hmm.
Some people, you know, feel that is wrong to do that. So it's led to some extremely interesting discussions and exchanges of viewpoints, too.
I'll bet it has. Now you've visited so many places and you've illuminated them for so many of your readers. Do you think you're ever going to go back and explore some parts of your native Australia in the same way?
Yes, I want to do that very badly. I have a red hot idea for a historical novel based on an actual person there. But right now, my oldest son is in the middle of his high schooling, and even though he was a bit of a nomad in his earlier years, I think that I owe it to him to let him have his high school years in this lovely place. So for right now, it's all here all the time.
Uh-huh. So you're not going to go explore Australia anytime soon and revisit?
Well, in a couple of years. That's my project, maybe the next after. So, yes, I do hope to get back there and water my roots and dig back into my native soil for a while.
I know you became a Jew when you married Tony. How has that changed your life? Has that enriched your life in ways that you never expected?
It does, because we have a fantastic Jewish community on the island and a really wonderful rabbi. She's a very learned and marvelous person, and I love to hear her exegesis on these issues that, you know, basically all people grapple with, about how to live a good life. And the beauty of Judaism is that Jews have been grappling and arguing for longer than most. And so there is a very fantastically rich and deep tradition of discussion and argument. And, you know, it suits me as a place to contemplate things that are other than the material life, because the whole of the observance is built around this book. And so when you're actually at the climax of the service, when you bow, it's to a book that you're bowing. And I find it very easy to feel comfortable with some kind of, you know, respect and admiration for thousands of years of people, God help us, trying to make sense of it all.
Have you spent time in Israel?
Oh, a ton of time. I covered the First Intifada and followed that story of the, you know, the so-called peace process until the Madrid conference. And, you know, I was basically back and forth in Israel a great deal when I was covering the Middle East.
And I want to ask you this, too. When you won the Pulitzer Prize, did that change you in any way? How did you react to that? Was it a huge surprise?
With a, you know, a great whoop of joy. it was completely beyond any ambit claim of my imagination. And I have to say, the day the call came, I couldn't have been more astonished. I actually didn't believe the news. I thought that the person who called me had made a mistake. Actually, my then 8-year-old son nailed it. I heard him. I was on the phone to a reporter after the announcement, and I heard him answering the door saying, "Mom can't come. She's so busy. She just got the Pulitzer Surprise."
The Pulitzer Surprise. That's great. Well, what are you working on now, since you're not going to be exploring Australia anytime soon? Are you working on anything in particular at the moment?
Yeah, I just finished a series of lectures for Broadcast in Australia, and it's an annual lecture series where you can discuss any manner of thing that interests you over a series of 4 broadcast lectures. And so I chose the idea of home and sound, that a capacious vessel into which to pour a lot of ideas about not only the experience of leaving a native home and finding a home in a different place, but also our responsibilities at this moment to our only home, which is this fragile and beautiful and very much endangered by our industrial activities on it.
So you're worried about environmental issues like so many of us?
I am exceedingly concerned about our failure to make any serious attempt to address the issue of climate change. And I've just returned from Australia, where I gave the first lecture in person, and Australia has passed carbon pricing legislation, and even though there's a lively political debate there between the more progressive party that's in power now and the more conservative-leaning party, there is a basic agreement that there is a crisis and that it needs to be addressed. So it's depressing to come back here and still have the absolute negating of science and the ridiculous climate denial still be such a feature of the political debate. You know, we are just burning down our only home to provide a few hours more light to party by.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that future generations are not going to be able to understand
mm-hmm.
what we were thinking.
I know you must be surprised, as all of us are, just by the whole shrinking of intelligence in the arena in politics right now. It's absolutely embarrassing to me as an American, you know.
It's pathetic. This is a great and extraordinary country with some of the most extraordinarily intelligent and innovative people in the world, and this crew is the best we can do?
I know.
Please.
Did you get involved in political issues on Martha's Vineyard and in Massachusetts?
I do. You know, you can't not. It's a very New England setup. We have our town meeting where we sit on the hard benches of the school auditorium and vote on every single item of the budget.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fabulous. I love it. I love the way that you are called to be engaged in the decisions of your community.
Mm-hmm. But we all wish more people would be engaged, you know. I mean, that's the other side of American politics. So many people are disengaged and refusing to get involved.
The year-round community here is a fairly engaged crew, and the arguments and discussions are lively. But unlike unfortunately, the national sphere, the argument is in the spirit of trying to seek the best solution
mm-hmm.
rather than just name-calling and abuse and one-upmanship.
Mm-hmm.
And so I know it's possible, and I wish I could get a few of these clowns over here to come to town meeting and see how it should be done.
Yeah, yeah. Tell us how you work. Do you get up and write every day? Are you a disciplined writer that feels that you must do that?
Yeah, I am, because I want to eat, basically. So I've got two kids, and I'm also very involved in caring for my mother, who's 92.
Mm.
And so it takes a pretty rock-hard discipline to use the amount of time I have, after having fulfilled those responsibilities, to absolutely get on with it. So basically, when the school bus leaves at 8 o'clock in the morning, I'm at work, and I try and stay at work until the school bus comes back.
Wow, what a full life you must have. It's amazingly filled with every moment, it sounds like, being busy.
It feels like that, and I also like to garden, so that's my great pleasure, that and taking the dog on very long walks. I try and fit that in as well.
Well, Geraldine Brooks, we have almost run out of time. Can you give some contact information, your website perhaps?
It's geraldinebrooks.com.
That's great. Well, Geraldine Brooks, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much. And again, the book is called Caleb's Crossing. Geraldine, thank you so much. Keep up the wonderful work.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.